Good day. Today is Sunday, 19th July 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, a couple of days ago, in fact, last week, we had a whole series of statements from the Kremlin, from Putin himself, and from his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, which at the time in my programmes, I suggested that the Russian approach to the conflict in Ukraine was about to change. Peskov, clearly speaking on Putin's behalf and saying this twice over the course of two different interviews, one with the Russian journalist Pavel Zarubin, and the second time in an interview to a Swiss newspaper, said that the conflict in Ukraine, as a result of the constant escalation by the Western powers, had developed into an actual war, leaving far behind its initial framework as set out by Vladimir Putin back in February 2022, which was a special military operation. He said twice that it was an actual war. And of course, as I pointed out at the time, this had legal significance. It meant that the Russians might expand the nature of their targets, would conduct operations in a more aggressive and ruthless way than they had previously. And I also said that I expected that eventually, probably sometime in the autumn, in light of comments that Russian officials were making about the terroristic nature of some of the actions taken by the Kiev government, some of the attacks on civilian facilities in Russia, to be precise, as being terroristic, that the Russians might upgrade the SMO, the special military operation, into a counter-terrorist operation. Well, that was said by Peskov. Another Russian official, the most senior Russian official of all, Vladimir Putin, also spoke about Russian strikes against Ukraine. He said that if the Ukrainians continued strikes against Russia, the Russians would mirror the strikes that Ukraine was carrying out by conducting their own much more powerful strikes against Ukraine. And over time, these strikes would steadily increase in intensity and become far more powerful. And if we go back a few weeks to May, the Russians also said that the Russians were moving towards, would start to attack decision-making centres in central Kiev itself. They told the Western governments to move their embassies and their diplomats out of Kiev. No Western government took that warning seriously. All the diplomats, all the embassies are still there. But as we will see in a moment, it is looking increasingly as if the Russians, on that warning, and as well as on the two implicit warnings that Peskov and Putin have given, that the Russians are being as good as their word. Now, I say this in light of the latest massive attack that the Russians conducted overnight against Kiev. Now, there's again debate as to the exact number of missiles used. Some reports say that around 30 Iskander missiles were used. The Ukrainians always, for some reason, say that it was Iskander-M missiles as well as S-400 missiles that the Russians launched against Kiev. As I've pointed out any number of times, the S-400 is an air defence missile. I don't believe that the Russians have at any point in time used air defence missiles as missiles to carry out ground strikes. For some reason unknown to me, despite the fact that the Russians clearly have no shortage of Iskander missiles, people persist in referring to these strikes by Russian ground-launched ballistic missiles against targets in Ukraine as being carried out by Iskander and S-400 missiles, as the Ukrainians claim, or Iskander S-400 missiles, of which, of course, there is no such creature. What I think is possible is that some of the ballistic missiles the Russians are using might be ultimately of North Korean production. But I don't know that for a fact, and I'm going to stick to calling all the ballistic missiles that the Russians use Iskander-M missiles. And supposedly around 30, some say more, some say up to 50 ballistic missiles were launched at Kiev over the course of last night. In addition to those missiles that were launched at Kiev, the Russians also launched Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missiles at Kiev as well. The general consensus is that around 10 of these missiles were used altogether. Now, there's a number of things that stand out about this massive missile strike. Some are again saying that this is the biggest missile strike that Kiev has endured since the beginning of the special military operation. There have been instances when the Russians have launched more missiles altogether on Ukraine than the, shall we say, 50 missiles that might have been launched towards Kiev last night. But when talking about, say, 70, 80, 100 missiles altogether in a single strike, well, those strikes which have happened in the past have been against targets all across Ukraine. Situations where up to 50 missiles are launched against one city, specifically Kiev, are something completely new, all but unprecedented, in fact. But putting aside the sheer scale of this attack, there was something else, as I said, that struck me immediately, which is that every single one of these missiles that was launched against Kiev last night was ground launched. They were immensely powerful missiles, but they were not launched from the air by aircraft. They were launched from the ground. That is true of the Iskander M's, and it is true of the Tsarkon missiles as well. And the reports say that these missiles were launched from launchers in Kursk, Bryansk, and Rostov regions in Russia. No aircraft appear to have participated in this strike at all. Now, this is important because missiles that are ground launched and which move at either very high supersonic speeds, like the Iskanders, or at hypersonic speeds, like the Tsarkons, reach their targets with only a few minutes' warning. When Russian bombers assemble to launch KH-101 subsonic missiles at Ukraine, when MiG-31s assemble to launch Kinzhal hypersonic missiles at Ukraine, the very fact that these bombers are assembling, are loading missiles, are taking off from the airfields, gives the Ukrainians warning that a strike is coming. Of course, the Ukrainians themselves, as by the way they've recently admitted, are not able to keep track of the movement of all of these bombers. They rely on Western satellite data to keep them informed. And no doubt that has been happening to a great degree. But when it comes to ground-launched missiles, the amount of prior warning that the Ukrainians receive is far less. It's more difficult to detect launchers, ground launchers, and ground launches than it is aerial launches. So Western satellites will struggle to keep track of the fact that the Russians are preparing these strikes. And of course, above and beyond all of that, the missiles, because they move so much faster than the KH-101 subsonic missiles and the Kalibr subsonic missiles launched from the Black Sea, they too come with very little or almost no warning. And obviously, the sharp reduction in warning times makes it much more difficult for the Ukrainians to respond to these missile strikes than they would have done in the past. By the way, there is another factor at play, which is, of course, Russian strikes using bombers also are more vulnerable, at least in theory, to Ukrainian countermeasures. The Ukrainians can strike at airfields, or they can, in theory at least, try to intercept, attack the bombers themselves, though the Tupolev bombers that launch the KH-101s do so from well within Russian territory. But it's the lack of warning time, as well as the enormous power of these missiles, much greater power of these ballistic missiles as compared with the subsonic cruise missiles, that makes the difference. And of course, the Ukrainians, as they have admitted themselves, are extremely short now of air defense missiles, and they have very, very great difficulty, therefore, shooting down pretty much anything. And the result is that these missiles rain down on Kiev and cause massive damage. Now, the Russian strike that took place last night apparently went on for something like 5 hours. But I understand that the part of the strike that was made up of the missile barrage lasted for no more than 1 hour. So 40 to 50 missiles, supersonic or hypersonic, hitting targets in Kiev within the space of 60 minutes. The rest of the strike, made up mostly of Garand drones, also conducting strikes around Kiev. And for the record, I believe that pretty much all of these Garand drone strikes on Kiev now are carried out by Gerand 4 jet-powered drones, and Marat Khairulin, the Russian reporter, has said that there is now also a Gerand 5, which he has described as a more sophisticated drone. He said it is practically a cruise missile in itself. Apparently, it has entered service. I know nothing more about it other than that it too is jet-powered, but it too perhaps was used in this attack on Kiev last night. Now, the Russians have provided an account of what this massive attack on Kiev achieved last night. And I would say that over and above and beyond what the Russians are saying, there's ample video footage of fires and explosions across Kiev taking place, and many reports of damage. And yesterday, or rather last night, as reports of the strike were coming in, there were also reports that the ceiling of one of Kiev's metro stations buckled under the pressure of this missile strike, which I have to say I find a very ominous piece of news. I'm not sure whether this is part of the ceiling of the underground structures of the metro station in question. Obviously, metro stations have both surface structures and underground structures as well. I hope it was not one of the underground structures, because as I happen to know, it is the metro stations that the people of Kiev ultimately mostly go to for protection when these massive strikes happen, because, to say it simply, there are not enough bunkers in Kiev to go round. Anyway, the Russians, as I said, have provided their own account of what was attacked, and they say that they attacked the Kiev Radio Electronics Enterprise Radionics, which manufactures control systems for the Flamingo cruise missile, the Neptune guided missiles. This is a ship launched missile which the Ukrainians also use in ground strikes, and the analog of the S-300 air defense missile that the Ukrainians also are trying to build, Project Kion. The Russians say that they severely damaged this plant. They say that it also provides technical maintenance and repair for onboard electro-optical targeting systems and for the airborne radars of the MiG-29 fighter jets that still remain the backbone of Ukraine's air force, with Ukraine, interestingly, continuing to import these fighter jets from Eastern Europe, even as they've been receiving F-16s and Mirage 2000s and Western fighter jets like that. Then the Artyom factory, which the Russians have repeatedly attacked, was attacked again. This produces, according to the Russians, components for the Flamingo cruise missile and for tactical missiles and also for Neptune missiles and for, again, the Ukrainian analog of the S-300 missile, which the Ukrainians are trying to put into production. And then the Kiev 90 manufacturing enterprise, which makes guidance systems and various assemblies for the Neptune missile system, the Orklyan factory, which manufactures components for long-range unmanned aerial drones, the Kiev sorting center, which is used for delivery and storage of dual-use products, including those intended for the production of drones, robotic systems, and electronic warfare systems. And then outside Kiev, but in the Kiev region, the Russians also say that they attacked a logistics center at a place called Tarasovka, which receives, stores, assembles, and distributes individual components and assemblies for the production of long-range drones and various fuel facilities, which we will come to later. So anyway, a massive, enormous strike. Now, some of people are saying that this strike was a reprisal attack following the Ukrainian strikes, the overnight Ukrainian strikes on the previous day against the Wildberries warehouses in Tambov and Elektrostal, which I discussed in my program yesterday. The Ukrainians admit that these two warehouses in Tambov and Elektrostal that they attacked were owned and operated by the Wildberries company, which, as I've said, is a sort of Russian equivalent to Amazon. It's heavily involved in e-commerce and all that. The Ukrainians claim that these warehouses were used by the Russian military to store drones and other military equipment. Well, they would say that. I remain deeply skeptical. I don't see why the Russians would want to turn to Wildberries and its facilities to store their drones. I would have thought this extremely unlikely. But to repeat again, I'm not there. I'm not in a position to inspect the rubble of these warehouses. I can't say what was actually there, but I can express an opinion. And my opinion very much is that these two warehouses were attacked because they were soft targets, not because they really contained military equipment or drones or anything like that, but because Ukraine's drone offensive against Russia is increasingly unsuccessful. The vast majority of the drones are being shot down. According to some reports now, well over 90%. And the result is that it is becoming more and more difficult for the Ukrainians to attack hard targets, actual military logistics centres, factories that form part of Russia's gigantic military industrial complex, oil refineries and oil storage facilities, ports and other such installations, which one can validly say are part of the Russian war effort and therefore make proper targets, or at least acceptable targets for attack. So that's my view. As I said, I know many people will push back. I don't know this for a fact, but that is why I think that the two Wildberries warehouses were attacked, in order to show that Ukraine is able to hit targets inside Russia, to sustain the flagging narrative of a successful Ukrainian drone offensive by showing pictures of destroyed warehouses. And the result is that warehouses, which I believe are exclusively for civilian use, those were attacked because the Ukrainians know that the Russians cannot protect every such warehouse across the massive territory of their country. Anyway, that was one massive strike that the Russians conducted yesterday. But they also conducted another massive strike using lots of different missiles. Not interestingly, the same sorts of missiles that were used in the strike against Kiev, but other types of missiles, KH-59 and I believe KH-69, air-launched cruise missiles. These are tactical missiles launched from Russian Sukhoi 34 and 35, and in some cases Sukhoi 57 fighter jets, Onyx anti-ship missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles, which the Russians use also for ground strikes, a little like the Ukrainians use the Neptune missile for ground strikes. The Onyx, however, is a much more sophisticated system than the Neptune. For one thing, it is supersonic. I believe that the strikes on Ukrainian targets are carried out from the territory of Crimea using these supersonic Onyx missiles. And the target, of course, again, was Odessa. And the Russians have also provided us with information about this. They also say that this strike was carried out against targets in Odessa, and they say that the Yuzhny port in Odessa region, where Ukraine stored fuel, was one of the targets that was attacked, though it looks like large parts of the port system in Odessa were attacked again. And the Russians also say that their drones continued to attack railway infrastructure across Ukraine, and they provided film footage showing this. Again, very interesting drone footage of a Garand 4 jet-powered, optically guided drone conducting a strike against a railway target, a railroad target, somewhere in Zaporozhye region. Again, no explanation about how the guidance is provided for this drone to carry out that strike. My continued belief is that the Russians are doing it using that part of the Rasvet satellite array, the Russian equivalent of the Starlink, which is already in operation. So, a night of enormous, devastating strikes on Ukraine, which took place last night. Now, of course, the Western media has discussed these Russian strikes. There's still, however, an extraordinary reluctance to discuss the effectiveness of these strikes or to make direct comparisons with the Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia. And the Western media is still clinging on to this narrative that the Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia is succeeding, even though they tend to downplay the effect of these immeasurably more powerful Russian combined missile and drone strikes on Ukraine. Well, there has been a scorching article published 2 days ago on the American Conservative, which basically demolishes that entire argument. And its title is "On Ukraine, Trump Now Buys the Tide-Turning Narrative." And It is by Leonid Rogozin. Now, I should explain that Leonid Rogozin is Russian. He is in no sense a supporter of President Putin or of President Putin's government. On the contrary, he is one of the most intelligent, insightful, and effective critics of President Putin and his government. To say it simply, he doesn't like President Putin at all. And I think I'm right in saying that Leonid Rogozin has always been a consistent critic of the special military operation, or perhaps we can now validly call it and uncontroversially call it, in light of what Peskov has said, the war between Russia and Ukraine. And, well, Rogozin's point is that the entire premise behind the drone offensive, Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia, the entire premise is wrong. And I'm going to pick some points from his article. He says that the Turning Tide campaign rests on a constellation of dubious assumptions about the state of the war, Russia's society and economy, and the West's ability to contain the conflict without it sliding into nuclear apocalypse. One assumption is that fuel shortages caused by drone strikes could make the war untenable for Putin by raising domestic political pressure. This line of thought derives from imagining modern Russians, or at least the Russian establishment, as snowflakes who will turn against Putin as soon as they have to wait a whopping 20 minutes to get their car fueled. There are multiple issues with this approach. First, Russians have experienced far worse economic and security conditions in living memory. Well, having been to Russia many times, before 2019, between 1998, when I first went to Russia, and 2019, when, until very recently, I stopped going to Russia, I can confirm that the Russia of 1998 was in a dreadful economic state, a world away from the Russia that you see today. And of course, 1998 is well within many people's economic memory. And he continues, if you need to figure out what kind of hardships a post-Soviet people can potentially endure, look no further than Ukraine, which successfully adapted to the near total destruction of its own large refineries earlier in the war, which is absolutely true, by the way. And then he continues, the problem is that Russian resilience is just beginning to be tested. Meanwhile, Ukraine's society and economy have worn down to a dangerous level that Russia, if the war of attrition continues, would take decades to reach. There is virtually no way for Ukraine and the West to make Russia so unlivable that Putin would end the invasion before Ukraine itself becomes completely lifeless. This equation has been obvious from the war's outset, although somehow not to its ardent cheerleaders. What Russia is doing now in response to Ukrainian strikes is inching towards total war. Note the way in which Rogozin here, I think unintentionally, is echoing what has just been said by Peskov, that we are no longer in a special military operation. We are in a state of actual war. And Rogozin now talks about Russia inching towards total war. I don't think it is anywhere close, by the way, to being total war. And I hope that we never get there. But there is no doubt at all that the Russians are now behaving with a ruthlessness that they did not show at earlier stages in the war. They never, for example, previously attacked grain ships, which of course they are now doing in Odessa and Nikolaev and such places, and doing systematically. But anyway, let's get back to what Rogozin says. He says, the Russians inching towards total war, with Russian drones and missiles methodically knocking out petrol stations in addition to energy infrastructure. Moscow has also begun to target food processing facilities, agricultural equipment, and trucks on highways. That is absolutely true. You can argue that some of this, some of the targets that the Russians are striking are dual use. But the point is that earlier in the war, the Russians placed restraints on themselves and avoided attacking these sort of targets. Now they are attacking them, just as they are attacking the Ukrainian railway system in a way that once they did not do, with growing effectiveness. And Rogozin continues, Ukrainians are bracing for another horrific winter in unheated apartments, whilst Russians are merely at the stage of making an extra effort to fuel their cars. The contrast couldn't be starker. In fact, it's even more stark than Rogozin says, because my own understanding is that the days through most of Russia of people having to wait to refuel their cars are, well, I won't say they've gone entirely. In Crimea, for example, they have not gone. But through much of Russia, the situation with fuel has abated significantly, and the days of long lines and arguments at filling stations, those increasingly are becoming fewer and fewer, and perhaps by the autumn, at least, they will have entirely gone. But anyway, I'm not going to dwell on that, because obviously I'm not in a full position to discuss this. Then Rogozin also says that most Russians have accepted the West's reasons, rather the Kremlin's reasons for the war, which, by the way, they have. I saw this last year in St. Petersburg, and this year in Pskov and in Moscow. Most Russians now see the war not as a war between Russia and Ukraine, but as a war between the collective West and Russia, with the collective West using Ukraine to try to defeat and damage Russia. And the Russians, the Russian population in its great majority, have accepted this narrative, this Kremlin narrative, because the narrative is true. As I've said many times, the Russian government, the Kremlin itself, is extremely poor at promoting narratives. It is because the narrative is essentially true, as the Russians themselves can see, that they have now accepted the truth of what their government is telling them about the war. But anyway, this is Rogozin. Compare the situation today in Ukraine. Look at what is happening in Kiev. Look at what has happened in Odessa. And be realistic and honest. Is there any resemblance at all to what has happened in Russia? Some places, at some points, in Crimea especially, there have been shortages of fuel at the petrol filling stations. Across eastern Ukraine, there are no shortages at petrol filling stations because the petrol filling stations have been destroyed. There are no queues, therefore, at these petrol filling stations because there are no petrol filling stations. The damage that Ukraine is suffering on a daily basis is on an immeasurably greater scale. And that is the reality. And that, by the way, takes us back to the political crisis that continues to play out in Kiev at the present time. Because even as the Russians continue with these massive strikes, people continue to protest in Kiev and in other Ukrainian cities. It's very difficult for me to assess the scale of these protests, but the general view is that the protests are actually growing in size and they have increasingly come to centre not on a demand that Mikhailo Fyodorov, the sacked defence minister, whose sacking, it was actually a sacking, was what first provoked the protests. It doesn't seem to be so much a demand for him to be brought back as a demand that General Sirsky, the commander of the Ukrainian military, that he be sacked as well. And, well, it's not surprising. Sirsky has always been a deeply unpopular figure in Ukraine. And yesterday, there were reports in the Financial Times that President Zelensky, faced with these protests on the streets, is now actively considering sacking Sirsky. And allegedly, in fact, I'm sure this is true, he's convened a meeting of top military commanders from across the Ukrainian armed forces, and he is consulting with them about Sirsky's position and whether or not Sirsky should indeed be sacked. Now, this is an eccentric way to decide whether or not a military chief should be sacked or not. Usually, if there's a decision made by the president of a country to appoint someone to the point to the position of chief military commander, it's the president who makes a decision whether or not to sack the military commander. He doesn't bring together the commander's subordinates and conduct a vote on whether the commander should be kept in post or not. But anyway, to me, it looks like preparations for Zelensky indeed to sack Sirsky and in some way to expand, to shift the responsibility for the consequences of sacking Sirsky away from Zelensky himself and to place it on the commanders instead. Now, I say that because a couple of weeks ago, there were already reports that President Zelensky was mulling a plan to sack Sirsky. According to most reports, he had told Senator Richard Blumenthal, who had come to Kiev, that he was planning to sack Sirsky, and replace Sirsky with his chief of staff, Kirilo Budanov, Ukraine's former military intelligence chief. Now, if this does indeed happen, we're going to be in a very interesting situation, because it seems that Zelensky still opposes reappointing Fyodorov to the point of defense minister and is now committed to making permanent his interim appointment of Yevgeny Khana as defense minister. Yevgeny Khana currently is acting defense minister of Ukraine in place of Fyodorov. The Ukrainian parliament made it clear that they were not prepared to vote for Klimenko, the police official that Zelensky initially wanted to appoint defense minister. Klimenko apparently is instead going to be made secretary of the Security Council, the National Defense and Security Council. So Zelensky picked Yevgeny Khana to become interim defense minister, but then he packed off the parliament on extended leave, which means that though the parliament has voted to fill all the other positions in the government, the defense and foreign ministers, Khana and Sibiga, currently are only interim appointments and will remain so until the parliament reconvenes in August. Now, that strongly suggests to me that Zelensky has no intention of reappointing Fyodorov to his post, to his former post. Now, if the rumours that Zelensky intends to sack Sirsky and to replace him with Budanov is true, then that will mean that both the defence ministry and the military itself, the uniformed military, will be commanded by intelligence officers. I say that because Budanov, who will be the military commander, is of course an intelligence officer. He was head of Ukrainian military intelligence, and before that he was a special forces soldier. And Khana has been the head of the SBU, Ukraine's counterintelligence and law enforcement agency, which also conducts intelligence operations inside Russia. And Khana has apparently been deeply involved in these operations inside Russia and is credited as being the mastermind behind Operation Spider's Web, the operation whereby Ukraine conducted drone strikes last year against Russian strategic air bases. So the military, the uniformed military, the men with a background in actual command will have been pushed aside, and people with no actual experience of battlefield command, people from the intelligence and security services, will be running the defense ministry and the military itself. Something which tells us a great deal about the situation in Ukraine at this particular point, and something which also tells us quite a lot about the direction that the war itself is taking. So that's one thing I want to say. As of now, we don't yet know for certain whether, in fact, it is indeed going to be the case that Sirsky is going to be sacked. My sense is that Sirsky still has considerable support within the uniformed military. The two Azov brigades have spoken out strongly in support of him. And as I have pointed out in my two previous programs, Sirski is arguably in the right over this quarrel with Fyodorov. Fyodorov has been the front man behind the Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia, which has failed. The drone offensive has absorbed enormous resources and huge amounts of money. The uniformed military has been deprived of those resources and is losing the battle on the battlefronts. And Sirski was absolutely correct to point this out and was absolutely correct to say that this is unsustainable. The Financial Times, which has published an article about Sirski and which is strongly supportive of Fyodorov, says that Sirski, for his part, has no plan for victory, no plan for Ukraine to achieve victory other than to hold out for as long as it can. That is absolutely correct. Neither Sirski nor his predecessor, General Zaluzhny, had a plan for victory. But then that is not because there is some great plan for victory which somehow is beyond the imagination of people like Zaluzhny and Sirski. It is because against an adversary such as Russia, a plan for victory by Ukraine simply does not exist. What Fyodorov's actions have done is perhaps accelerate the moment of Ukraine's defeat, certainly accelerate perhaps the loss of Donbass, and provide the Russians with the excuse to impose an extremely tough sea blockade of Odessa and of Ukraine's ports, and to block Ukraine's ability to export foodstuffs and grains and things of that kind. But it absolutely, the drone offensive idea absolutely did not contain within it a plan for victory. As Rogozin's article in the American Conservative correctly points out, this fact that Ukraine has no pathway to victory, made all the way back in 2022 by Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis in a brilliant article, I remember that he wrote at that time, is one that far too many people in the West continue to resist. What instead we have is constant escalation. What Rogozin describes as insane levels of escalation, which ultimately end up taking us absolutely nowhere, creating a worse, leaving Ukraine in a worse situation than it would have been in if it had come to a peace, a negotiated peace with Russia. I'll read again from Rogozin's piece. Every time when peace proposals have been rejected, there's been hair-raising escalation, resulting in enormous and partially irrecoverable losses for Ukraine in lives, territory, infrastructure, with Russia pressing even harder than before. Every time Ukraine emerges from the escalatory period, it faces far more disastrous terms for peace than it could previously have achieved. And there is no indication this time that it will be any different. And that is absolutely correct. With every opportunity for peace that has been thrown away, with every decision by the West to gamble on escalation, Ukraine's position deteriorates and the demands that the Russians make simply increase. Well, anyway, that's what I'm going to say. To repeat again, if Syrsky is sacked, if he's replaced by Budanov, if the new team that takes over is going to consist of Khana and Budanov, they have no more ability to change the overall direction of the war than their predecessors, than Syrsky or Zeluzhny or Umerov or whoever was there before them. None of them, no one in the West, no one in Ukraine can come up with a realizable, achievable plan for victory by Ukraine against an adversary as huge and as powerful as Russia. Well, in the meantime, the Russians continue their advance, and we have now had another update on the state of the war from the overall Russian military commander and chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces, Valery Gerasimov. He has attended another command headquarters. He's given another briefing about the war, and he's told us again some very, very interesting things. He says, for example, that the Russians are making significant progress in the Dobropilia area, that they've captured a whole string of positions in the area of Dobropilia, and that the situation for the Ukrainians there is deteriorating. He's spoken about the Russians having captured more territory in Zaporozhye region, the eastern part of Zaporozhye region, showing that the pincers around Orekhov are tightening. And Gerasimov gave us what I suspect is a definitive update about the situation in Liman. He said that organized Ukrainian resistance in Liman has been completely broken, not just in Liman itself, but around Liman, and that this important strategic logistical center is indeed about to be fully captured by the Russians. I pointed out about 2 days ago that the Russian Defense Ministry had published a statement by a Russian military officer in the Liman area saying that the entire territory of Liman is in fact under Russian control. I think that Gerasimov's words clarify the position. The Russians are indeed in overall control of Liman, but they're continuing to clear the town. They're continuing to clear the town of scattered Ukrainian groups. And following Gerasimov's words, I expect that at some point within the next few hours, the Russian Defense Ministry will indeed announce the fall of Liman. And after the fall of Liman, other places nearby will fall, including the important town of Sviatogorsk with its famous monastery, various forested areas nearby. And I suspect that the Russians will begin shortly after an attack on a village called Radnorok, which lies between Liman and Slavyansk. There was a lot of speculation, I remember, when the Russians first captured Liman back in May 2022, that they would move on to capture Radnorok. It never happened, but this time I suspect that will indeed follow. Gerasimov also said that the Russians have successfully repelled all Ukrainian counterattacks in the Kupiansk area. I'm not going to discuss that further in this program. But anyway, the overall effect of all of this, what Gerasimov is telling us, is that the war on the battlefronts continues to move in Russian favor. And in fact, a Ukrainian officer, Brigadier General Sergei Sobko, who I understand is the chief of staff of Ukraine's 11th Corps, has now actually published a post on Facebook in which he says that the Ukrainian military is in urgent need of reform, and then goes on to say, otherwise, we may be defeated. He says the professional discussion is often perceived as loyalty and initiative as a threat, and this has discouraged commanders from taking risks for the sake of success. Now, many are interpreting these words as possibly implied criticism of Sirski, and that may indeed be so. All I will say is, here we have an active Ukrainian officer, an officer who's actually involved in the fighting, and he's come out and said publicly on Facebook that Ukraine on the battlefields is indeed losing the war. And before I finish with my rundown of what is actually going on the battlefields, I'm going to discuss also briefly an article that appeared in the Ukrainian magazine Strana. Strana is a Ukrainian magazine. It is opposed to President Zelensky, and for that reason publishes abroad, but it remains very committed to Ukraine and supports Ukraine, I think it's fair to say, in the special military operation. Anyway, Strana has, it claims, been in touch with a military source, a source within the Ukrainian military, which discusses criticisms that have been made of Sirski's tactics. But listen to what this source says. This is Zelensky's tactics, not Sirski. Zelensky demands a constant offensive, demonstrating results. Sirski thinks in much the same way. At the same time, Zelensky thinks not so much in military terms as in informational and political ones. He wants to prove to the West that Russia lacks the initiative on the front so that there will be more enthusiasm in allocating money and weapons. And he wants to prove to Moscow itself that not only can Russia no longer advance, but that it is also losing territory. Therefore, Russia should consider making concessions. So the result is constant pressure to take the initiative and to launch offensives. Judging by our active actions in the Zaporozhye region, the idea of physically cutting off the land corridor to Crimea has still not been abandoned. However, This strategy has its opponents. They believe that such counteroffensives only exhaust the Ukrainian army. They lead to greater losses. Zelensky and Syrsky say that the Russians have more losses than we do. It is true. But at the same time, it is rarely said why their losses are higher. It is because they're on the offensive in most areas. In modern drone warfare, the attacking side always suffers significantly greater losses than the defending one. And when we attack, the proportions change. In such cases, it is Ukraine which suffers the greater losses, not the Russians. We don't have that many men. Therefore, it is impossible to say that such counterattacks have any significant success. We couldn't recapture Kupiansk, where the Russians were in a very vulnerable position. Now the Russians are advancing there. Attempts to recapture even the outskirts of Pokrovsk have come to nothing except heavy losses. There is very strong military opposition to the current strategy, proposing a shift and a change to a defensive play, focusing on long and medium term strikes against the Russian rear, as well as identifying and eliminating drone operators. Well, the problem with that is that going on the defensive, as Syrsky himself has said, simply sets up the Ukrainians for further attacks by the Russians. One of the reasons why Ukraine has been able to hold positions is because it counterattacks. And those counterattacks may exhaust the Ukrainians, but in some places they do slow the Russians. Simply staying on the defensive, as I think Syrsky has correctly said, is itself in the end a losing strategy. Well, anyway, I'm not going to discuss this, but the key point that this article is making is that the defensive strategy that some people, both in Ukraine and in the West, have been advocating is a strategy that has not only been rejected by Syrsky, it has been rejected by Zelensky himself, who thinks of the war mostly in information terms. And we've seen this again play out in Konstantinovka, where Zelensky and the Ukrainian leadership continue to pretend that Konstantinovka is under Ukrainian control, and where they've now released another video purporting to show Ukrainian soldiers raising their flags inside Konstantinovka, except that various people who understand these sort of things have pointed out that the video footage that they've released is fake and is obviously AI generated. I am not going to go into the details of all of that. Anyway, this is what I'm going to say today about the situation in Ukraine. There are some, like Scott Ritter, who is saying that we have now reached a turning point, that the impact of the Russian strikes, together with the blows the Russians are inflicting on the ground, and the political crisis in Kiev, all point to the moment when attrition finally has its full effect and we start to see the whole structure of Ukrainian defense begin to crack. Well, that remains to be seen. But certainly, in my opinion, the situation for Ukraine has never been more difficult And I hope in this program, at least, I have explained why. Now, there is the other war that is also going on, which is the one in the Persian Gulf. And there's been a very, very disturbing statement that has been published on independent media, which supposedly originates from someone within the Iranian military leadership. I'm not sure who, and I'm not sure that this statement really has been made by any person who actually belongs to the Iranian military leadership. But this person supposedly is saying that after the failure of the Memorandum of Understanding, after the American attacks on Iranian infrastructure, Iran itself has now reached the point where its strategic patience is exhausted, and that we are at the point of no return, and that Iran is now working on its own plan to bring the war home against the United States and its allies in the Middle East, with attacks on military, strategic and other targets. And the targets that this military official identified apparently included the desalination plants, which are vital for the continued functioning of the great cities across the Middle East. Well, if we really are in that situation, if the Iranians really are about to attack the desalination plants, and this official seemed to suggest that the initial targets, the first desalination plants that would be attacked were those in Kuwait. If that is indeed about to happen, then the Middle East crisis is about to reach a level of escalation that we have never seen up to now. And, well, I don't want to discuss or predict the consequences of such a step before it happens. But what I would say, if it does happen, is that we would be looking not just at a geopolitical disaster, potentially, but at a humanitarian disaster as well, potentially on an epic scale of a kind that we have not seen in any conflict up to now. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.